is Spill the Wine. I am Christoph Ellinghaus. Welcome back. This week, we're talking to Ryan Lott. Ryan Lott is Sun Lux, and Sun Lux is Ryan Lott. He lives in LA. We met in LA. It was almost a chance meeting. Okay, here's a disclaimer. Sun Lux signed to City Slang. City Slang is my record label. City Slang is the sponsor of this episode of Spill the Wine. So I can do this kind of thing, right? I can say, hey, this episode is brought to you by City Slang because City Slang is releasing the new Sun Lux album, Brighter Wounds, on February 9th. Go check it out on all your, it's in every record store, on vinyl and compact disc and as a tragic download and a depressing stream. And should you like it, go back. They have a huge catalog of great music out there on multiple labels. So they called us up. They reached out. They said, hey, City Slang, we want to work with you. And the band had a lot of fans inside my company. So we checked them out. We met up backstage at a French festival last summer. This is good. So, you know, you've been to an open air festival. The catering is shit. The beer is just traumatizingly bad. This French festival is close to the Alps and it's close to the French region called the Jura and Eurocayenne. It's a great festival. It was, what a mixture. ZZ Top, Beck, and then Sun Lux and Caribou and The Kills and M83 and whatever French things. So we met in a damp green sort of backstage tent, and they're selling French oxidized wine at the festival. I thought I was in heaven. Jura wine, Sauvignon, Chardonnay, oxidized. You know, the stuff that people would spit out over here. They're selling it at a festival. I was in love with the place and met Sun Lux, who were amazing. So that was good. So we met, we hit it off, but it was like a 5-minute meeting. No, five, maybe an hour. And I think we all walked away from having an okay feeling, but didn't really, you know, they had just played a show. I had had a bunch of oxidized wine. So when we met again, when I was in LA, I said, hey, want to come on be interviewed for my podcast? Because I can now ask you all these stupid questions like, where do you come from? Why do you make the music you make? How did this all come together? And he gladly came in. We went into my depressing hotel room and we did this. So listen to us chatting away in LA while the fires are burning around us. I hope you'll get something out of this. Sun Lux, here's Ryan Lott and me chatting away. You can tell me everything. Yeah. You can tell me your whole backstory. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in different parts of the country, which is something I've been pretty thankful for. The United States is kind of, the more I've visited other countries, the more I've thought about how the United States is like a bunch of different countries.
Well, it's big.
Yeah. It's not just big though. It's like culturally, it's like.
Well, that comes with the size of it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it allowed for a certain colorful spectrum to develop over time. I grew up mostly in the Northeast to a family that is very Southern, which was pretty interesting.
Huh.
Most of my family still lives in the South. Most of my wife's family lives in the Midwest. There's a small contingent on the east, on the West Coast here, but we're both kind of black sheep in the family.
Where in the South?
Georgia.
Okay.
My dad grew up in Georgia. My mom grew up in North Carolina, but my parents are in Georgia. My sister and her family are in Georgia. And my brother's in North Carolina. And then my wife grew up in Indianapolis. But I've lived in 9 different states. So
in how many years?
In how many years of being alive?
Yeah.
38.
You're 38, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've lived in one of those states, California, 3 times, and then New York I've lived twice, so I've moved a lot.
That's the most, I think, biggest sort of difference between, I think, like, well, Germans or Europeans, you guys move around in this country a lot. It's just a perfectly normal thing here to pack up your things.
Yeah.
Get the U-Haul and haul it across the country.
Well, yeah, but again, that's a size difference, right?
Nine times.
I mean, until...
No, but the mobility. I'm talking about just this whole...
Yeah, but the European... The concept of the European Union is relatively new, right? So it's like there isn't like this like longstanding culture of moving somewhere that would take 17 hours to drive, right. You know? Because it wasn't really possible until relatively recently, where that's just been the gist here, you know?
But it's just, I'm talking about the frame of mind of like, you know, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't work out for me here, I'm going to just pack up my things and leave. And I think people are a lot more rooted, you know, in Europe to a degree.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true. Although I also think it's interesting that the opposite of that is totally true, which is that a huge amount of people in this country don't ever leave where they were born and wouldn't even consider it. So long as, you know, because it, and it's generally, at least the way I understand it is it's people who do what their parents did and then, and what their parents did in places where whatever that is sustainable.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been seeing is really falling apart here too in the United States, which is that, you know, your grandfather might have been in steel and your father was in steel, but there's no more steel work in Ohio or whatever. And so now you're really pissed and you feel totally homeless in a sense because there's no home for your purpose, the purpose that you would have inherited. And for the first time, you're thinking, oh, maybe I have to uproot my family and I have to go somewhere else. And that kind of uncertainty, you know, foments all sorts of anger that's misdirected. And I think provides a context for
what's happening right now.
What's happening right now.
Yeah,
but it's not even right now. What's happening, what we realize has been happening.
It's been building
for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. But man, yeah.
Okay, so the Northeast was the sort of
which and the Northeast is a lot
like
more
where exactly
in Connecticut.
Okay,
tiny state surrounded by small and tiny states. That was I really loved growing up there, and I played soccer.
Really?
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
Why?
Weren't you the outsider?
Oh man!
I mean, soccer arrived on a larger scale here in 94 with the World Cup, right? Before that,
it was absolutely not. In the Northeast, it was huge. I mean, it was
really
absolutely. It's been huge for a long time. My whole life, there were huge soccer complexes. Like when I moved to Connecticut in 83, 84, something like that. I was a little kid, and there was already huge soccer facilities, like indoor soccer facilities there, tons and tons of outdoor fields. It was the primary, at least from my experience, it seemed like the primary sport for youth.
So you're into it now? You're in, like, do you follow it?
I can't follow it because I don't, you know, it was just a time in my life where I never watched TV or I never really, and it was like kind of pre-internet or like early internet where you couldn't just like, you couldn't just like find whatever you wanted and watch it live and stuff like that, you know, on your DSL modem or your dial-up modem or whatever. Yeah. So, but basically what happened is I played soccer my whole life, until I was like 16, I think. And I was, and that's when we moved to Georgia and I went to high school in Atlanta, and, the kids there played soccer like they were playing American football. And it was
like very physical.
Just brute force. Like it was, and I was like I was fast, but I tried to be a smart player, like a playmaker, you know?
Yeah, you're not a big physical guy.
No, I'm a tiny dude. And basically I stopped growing which was doable in the Northeast the way the game was played, but at least at that age. But you know, when basically my my team in high school was just full of kids off season, you know, football kids off season. You know, it was just like I had no prayer. Mm. You know, it was all about, I just couldn't stay on the ball.
So then you just quit.
Well, at the same time, I mean, I needed to make a decision between a bunch of things, mm-hmm. or only doing music.
Oh, so okay. And when did the music start?
Well, I started music at that point. I was like well into music, but it was like it was right at the point in which I was like I needed to decide: is this going to be like who I am for life or not?
At 16?
Oh, absolutely.
Really? I mean,
dude. Yeah. If I hadn't decided by that, that was the bitter end of when I could have decided, I think, for sure.
Well, it's not like you're 16 and you go pro, you know.
Well,
did you?
No. Well, but I was performing professionally then, but
at that age.
Yeah, bands and stuff like that.
In bands, yeah. In high school bands.
Yeah, high school bands.
But you wouldn't go to clubs.
I was in a pretty serious band in high school, actually.
You couldn't get into a
bunch of older... No, I couldn't, but I had to... My bandmates were all older and in college and stuff like that. I could do the thing where I was just like sitting by the door, mm-hmm. you know? Like mm-hmm. if it was like a nightclub or something, they would put me by the door or something like that.
Wait, so you could bail?
No, it was just like, you know, they just allowed it.
Right.
And then, you know.
He's not what, by the door, as in he's not really inside the club? Look, he's
there may be. I think there's probably the some like, at least at that time, there was some accommodation, some legal accommodation for young performers.
So what was the first instrument you picked up?
Well, I started with piano because it was a family rule.
A family rule.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Everybody, your sister,
yeah,
your...
my sister and brother and I, we had to take starting at six. We had to take piano lessons, and
did they all enjoy him?
We all hated it. Yeah, we all hated it.
You hated it too.
I hated it. Right. Yeah, I hated it for, and of course,
now you're thankful.
I am extremely thankful, yeah. But I really hated the piano. I hated piano lessons. Mm. All the way through college, and I studied music in school, and even the very last piano lesson I took when I was 22 years old or whatever, I hated. You know what I mean?
Does it have to do with the teacher as well?
Or no, because I had amazing teachers.
Oh yeah,
I really had amazing teachers. I had a fundamental problem with internalizing the music of other people and convincingly and honestly delivering it. Mm-hmm. Through the piano.
Where you wanted to do your own
stuff
from the get-go?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not from the get-go, but at some point, like when I was about 11, when I was 9.
That's pretty much the get-go.
No, I was 9, I think. I started to get this feeling like I wanted something different than what was on the page. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't... I think that
That's kind of early to have that freewheeling approach to it, no? I mean, I guess for some.
I think for some. I mean, yeah. Mozart had written operas and symphonies by that point. So, like, there's a spectrum.
But he's not the norm.
Well, hopefully I'm not the norm either.
No, you're not.
But no, I know what you mean. Yeah, and yeah, you're right. It was early for a kid to start, like, writing music, especially since that kid... hated piano lessons. Mm-hmm. So, and I think my parents and my teacher recognized that dichotomy. They recognized that my eyes lit up when I thought about making my own stuff or playing mm-hmm. my own stuff, but they darkened and got full of tears when I was playing other people's stuff. Mm. And I had a piano teacher, my first piano teacher had the foresight and the sort of the wherewithal to say, okay, you can play what you hear in your mind. You can change what Mozart has written, but you have to also learn what Mozart wrote. Right. And so that's the compromise. And that was a really smart move on mm-hmm. her part, because it didn't just throw out the baby with the bathwater, but it definitely made sure that I was doing what was, you know, on the page, but also totally opened up the possibility that what was on the page wasn't like the God's truth, right? And that was a really cool doorway to just really starting from scratch with my own compositions. And by the time I was 11, I was entering these little like piano, these little composition competition things that my parents had like figured out existed, you know,
for 11 year olds. Or were you?
Yeah, I was on the younger side of things, but it was like young composers, competition things like that. And there was one of them nearby at, it was hosted, it was at Yale, which was nearby. Mm-hmm. And, one of the judges, basically my parents like bribed one of the judges to be my new teacher. Cause my first piano teacher had come to my parents and said, hey, this kid needs, you know, something more than just like the neighborhood piano teacher, and he's maybe got something, and you should look into someone like basically better than me to see if that's true. And my parents were always super, super supportive of my music.
And it sounds like that. So yeah. did your sister and your brother also?
No, they hate it. And they full on hated it.
Like, so they just weren't even going, I want to do my own stuff.
No, yeah. And so the rule is by the time you get to middle school, then we can say, see ya.
Oh, okay.
Middle school is like, what, 11 or 12? So, yeah. But right around that time, that's when I was introduced to this woman who was a professor at Wesleyan University and at Yale. Mm-hmm. And she took me under her wing as her student, which was amazing because I was her only student that wasn't in college. And so part of my tutelage was actually going to Wesleyan University and being part of her studio there. So that was amazing to kind of catch a glimpse of like full on formal music education. And she taught me calligraphy, notation, and composition and piano. And it was a very, very traditional approach to music education, but I mean, it was amazing. And she was the first one who said, when she could tell that I clearly was not practicing, she said, she asked me, why are you not practicing? And I was like, well, it's not fun anymore.
Right.
And she said, at some point, you're going to have to decide if there's more to this than having fun. When she said that, part of me knew that there was more to it and that there was something deeper that I could access if I wanted to. It was going to be up to me.
And that was practice?
No, that was just like a deeper experience of music that was beyond just the fun of playing. And for a kid, I was maybe at the time, like, so that would have been, I was like probably 12. For her to kind of say that to me and for it to hit me heavy then was, I think, the perfect timing.
That's heavy. That's
heavy
stuff.
Yeah, it is heavy.
12-year-old.
But she knew me well enough to know, and I think she probably was like taking a bit of a gamble, but I also think that she knew that there's something in me that wasn't going to stop. Mm-hmm. But then it's funny, then we moved to Atlanta and I found another great teacher, but before I did, I took up the drums and I got more into playing guitar and stuff like that. So I started down this path and my parents were cool with it. They were the fact that they let me like buy a drum set and let me bang the drums in the basement after listening to me play Beethoven for years on the piano. I imagine that was a pretty intense whiplash.
So what triggered the interest in the other instruments then? Were you listening to music at the time?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was always like, you know, I was always like playing in bands as a kid and stuff. And, you know, so my guitarist in my band would teach me how to play the guitar, and my drummer in the band would teach me how to play drums. And
you would pick it up like that?
No. I wasn't like one of those kids. I definitely was not like, I mean, there's a spectrum.
It didn't come easy?
No, I mean, at the time that I started to like, really like, oh fuck, I'm going to buy a drum set. And I'm mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play drums. Mm-hmm. By that time, you know, I was like, what, 13, 14 years old, and I had been playing piano for six or seven or eight years, you know? So, so yes, it came easy, quote unquote.
Easier than to other people who would like start from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because I was bringing a lot of the other skills that I developed into the drum set. Well, another thing my mom and dad did is they bought me when I was, I think it was for my 11th birthday, they bought me my first synth. And the synth had a built-in sequencer. It was a Roland D20. And that's when I started to learn how to track multiple parts and layer them and bounce them down and stuff. And so that sequencer was like, and I would save it to floppy disks.
Right.
And I just had like stack of floppy disks of all these. And I was making beats like on this like really crappy but amazing synth, right? And designing sounds and getting into it. And that's actually... So a bunch of these things were happening in parallel, you know, and it's funny looking back, I can see where it all started, you know, it's like this synth and that band that I was in and that yellow drum set, and those piano lessons and that crazy lady who told me that I have to, either music's for fun or it's for something much, much deeper. You know, it all kind of makes sense. And then by the time I got to high school, my parents found this crazy teacher. Was a student of Bernstein, and he was like a rocker, but he was this amazing pianist and composer and arranger, but he was like totally off his rocker. He's totally insane, like conspiracy theorist guy, like believed he was abducted by aliens, all this, like he was totally wild.
Really?
Yeah.
Those people also actually exist.
Actually exist. But this guy was like off the charts amazing. His brain was like another level. When I showed up the first time to this house, it smelled like smoke and it was full of like junk and like random like studio like pieces of gear and like all this like this crazy like alien paraphernalia all over the walls. And
I can picture that.
Yeah. And I was like, oh man, what's this guy going to do? Like, and I keep in mind, I'd come from like Wesleyan University and like, you know, like you know, and I was, and it was like a very proper approach to.
Wait, so that your parents sent you to this?
Yeah, because this guy was also the music pastor at the church.
Oh, your family was Christian?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, and I only agreed to
like pretty heavily.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Really conservative. Yeah. But I only agreed to like that this was a good idea to take from him because at church I noticed that he was a badass. Like even though they were playing like pretty crappy music, I could tell that he was a total badass. And he was like the one guy on stage who had long hair and like ripped jeans and mix match Converse and earrings. And like he was the
freak pastor.
He was the freak, you know? And I was like, well, this guy's probably actually pretty cool. And turns out he is, he's amazing.
And at this point you're 14.
Yeah. And that stuff matters. You
know?
So, I went to, so I was probably 15 and then I started with him and he, you know, and I sat down at the piano and there's like a poster of Robert Plant and Jimmy Page rocking out over overhead. And to the right, Kurt Cobain crowd surfing. And then to the left, like a semi-ironic poster of Winger.
Oh, they were amazing. Their look was fantastic.
They had a look, yeah.
They were the poodle rock
look. Yeah, totally. Amazing. And this guy was a little bit like that.
So you were playing
in bands. He's the one who rescued me from like real deep musical snobbery.
Okay. How so?
Because he taught me amazing things about music that I had kind of looked down upon. And
like what?
Like all kinds of rock music and pop music. Like
you were literally looking down on.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I was like this classical music snob. Yeah, I was, but you know, like.
Well, you were, I'm assuming you weren't doing covers in that band because you didn't want to cover Mozart earlier on.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I was, in a sense, I was duplicitous, you know, in the way I was thinking about music. Like, yes, I love the stuff that I was playing in bands, but I also kind of, a part of me looked down on it. And I think I didn't necessarily realize that about myself, but now looking back, I see that I kind of like thought about this kind of music belongs over here, and then this kind of music belongs up here.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you were categorizing. Okay.
Yeah. Which, you know, which
compartmentalizing it and just,
compartmentalizing yeah. and creating a hierarchy in my mind, which right. which maybe was a necessary step for me in my brain in order to give the sort of like reverence to the music that I was having, that I was studying so that I would have the energy and the respect it took to actually fucking practice the piano, right? Yeah. Because if you think about a piece of music like you're supposed to revere it, then it's going to be easier to like go through the slog of learning it, right? Right, yeah. Whereas if you're like, oh yeah, here's a piece of music that like take it or leave it, and you don't really have a so. Yes, I was definitely snobby, and I was thinking about music in hierarchical terms. But
that's also a youthful thing to absolutely. Do when you're very young.
Yeah,
and
most
teenagers,
yeah, absolutely, you know, absolutely. Like, eh, there's a function to
you
it.
You dismiss a lot that you. Know.
Yes, and Jay, he helped me. Like, okay, like the first lesson was like he's like, okay, play me something. So then I play him some like real fancy shit that I'd written.
You
right,
to show off, of course.
Yeah, and you know. Genuinely, you know, I could always play music. I could always play the piano really well if I was playing my own stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. I tricked one of my professors at school into taking me on as a student by playing one of my own pieces. And then I came to the first lesson playing what I normally play. And I could tell that he was like, oh shit, what have I done? But with Jay, so he's like, play me some something. So I played him some fancy shit. And then he said, okay, cool. Now play me a pop song.
And
I said, no, I don't play a pop song. Like I don't play pop music. He's like, oh, why don't you play pop music? He's like, I don't know. And he's like, okay.
It's beneath me.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And so he's like, okay, first lesson, write a pop song.
All right.
And then, you know, then I showed up the next week and I hadn't done it.
You hadn't.
Cause I couldn't. I tried.
Oh.
And then he was like, all right, well, there you go. See?
that's amazing.
It was a really good lesson. Yeah.
So,
and that happened in various ways throughout my life after that too. So,
okay. So you're really talented playing your own stuff. You probably, obviously, you know, you have a talent for this kind of stuff, and then you go in a band, and not everybody in a band in high school age is good.
Yeah.
So how did you feel about your, you
well, know, I played in a really sucky band, but I was the drummer of that band, so mm-hmm. it was okay that we sucked. And then I played in a really good band, and I was the only kid. I was like 3 years younger than the other youngest person, and they were like in college. And that band was actually really, really good. And everybody in that band was really serious about music. Mm-hmm. And in fact, half of us are professional musicians now, oh, yeah. And we're still friends. And in fact, one of the guys who I met on my 15th birthday is one of my closest friends, and he's had a really important role in my career. So
sweet.
Yeah, so I learned so much I think about music and about making music in a familial kind of context, mm-hmm. When I was young, which I feel especially lucky about, because as a pianist especially, which is generally a solitary pursuit until you're in college and you're playing in trios and quartets and things, it's not like you're a violinist or clarinetist or a drummer or something like that, or a bass player,
yeah.
where you're like, you constantly need other people to like do your thing. A pianist, you sort of can go off on your own and be your own thing. And that can lead to a certain isolationism musically that I feel like I avoided by playing bands, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, so after high school, you mm-hmm. went to college.
Yeah, I went to music school.
And where?
At Indiana University, mm-hmm. Which is a really, really fantastic school of music. And I met some great musicians there. Again, some people that I'm still very close with.
But did that format suit you and your
no.
wide
yes
mind?
And no. And, yes and no. Mm. It was a more traditional school, and in some ways really rubbed me the wrong way. I think the tension benefited me well. The fact that I was like, basically what I was doing was getting a parallel education,
mm-hmm.
because playing in bands, like with the jazz guys and with guys, you know, guys from the jazz school and people from outside of music, outside of the music school entirely, they were, you know, I was learning from them in a certain way, certain things, and gaining a certain experience, you know, playing in clubs and jumping up, you know, stage diving and stuff like that, you know? So I had that life, but then I had this like...
Wait, you jazz bands and stage diving?
No, we played, I played in a funk band. I played funk and like, kind of like...
Oh yeah, there's stage diving and funk?
Oh dude, we were crazy. We were really wild.
Right.
So were you... It was, we integrated a lot of like hip hop and rock and stuff. And it was original music. That's when I really started to learn how to arrange for players. Cause in that band, I was arranging for saxophones and writing parts for drums and things like that. And that's when I first actually started to toy with creating music using a computer, which I didn't ever study formally. I didn't go to school. I didn't touch for as part of my formal music education, I didn't touch a computer except to notate like chamber music.
Okay, you know? What year are we in now? Because computers.
So 97 was I went. Okay. I graduated in 97, and then I had high school, and then I graduated college in 2001. Mm-hmm. And then I got the hell out of Dodge because I was like, I felt like I was ready. I was like ready to be done with an academic environment. Mm-hmm. Because remember, I started in an academic, like a pretty intense academic environment when I was 11. Yeah. So by the time I was 20. Whatever, 20, 22, I was just like, yeah, this is like, yeah, I'm just, you know, and I could feel the constraints of like an academic way of thinking about music that were starting to make me, just starting to make me feel uncomfortable.
Or just wasn't inspiring.
Yeah. It was maybe inspiring the wrong kind of, I don't know. It's like, it started to feel, you know, the right, it's like when you're making like a smoothie and you're like kind of adding like different fruits and vegetables and like you're constantly tasting it. Mm-hmm. I guess it kind of felt like, okay, this is good. I feel like I can leave here feeling really good. But if I was here another year, I feel like I would fuck up the chemistry of that smoothie and it wouldn't taste good anymore.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. So,
yeah.
So what'd you do next?
I got married.
Indiana, you met your future wife.
Yeah, that's right. Her name's Jen, and we met earlier in school, and we got married about a month after we graduated in 2001, which was June 2nd, 2001.
And so how long had you known each other by then?
Since we were 19, so we were officially like engaged for like a year and a half, so...
So you made that decision early on.
Yeah.
In the relationship.
Yeah.
She's the one.
She is the one. Yeah. Okay. And
he's the one.
Yeah.
Okay. Sweet.
And then, we did some traveling early on and kind of living out of a car and on couches and stuff. And, we made our way to Cleveland, Ohio, where Jennifer and I, mainly Jennifer, helped start up a modern dance company there that is still very active and flourishing there. And in Northeast Ohio, there's this weird, it's a kind of a weird hotbed of dance. There's like a lot of dance coming out of Northeast Ohio and has been for a long time. And, so we both moved there and Jennifer, worked with the company dancing and I was like kind of like the in-house composer. Mm-hmm. So I was like there to write and they did a lot of outreach to kids who didn't have grow up with like a privileged dance education and stuff. So they specifically worked with a lot of young people that didn't have the opportunity to have formal training and they started outreach programs for kids like that. And so there was always like different kinds of pieces of music that need to be written for different things. And that was fantastic for me. That's really where I started to cut my teeth on writing different styles. You know, this piece needed, you know, a hip hop beat. This piece needed some weird noise, music concrete thing. This piece needed to sound like a classical piece of music. This piece needed to be like honky tonk piano, you know, things like across the board. Like I was always doing like different things. And
was that a like a funded thing? Was it funding for that?
I mean, we were just really poor, you know. So mm-hmm. we just basically made barely what we needed to survive. But it was also a really cheap place to live.
Mm-hmm.
I did manage to get a couple grants while I was there, and that helped me fund some upgrades to my equipment and stuff like that. But for the longest time, I just had the most bare bones. In fact, the first commission I ever did, I had a recorder kind of like you have here, except it was a DAT tape. Mm-hmm. You remember
yeah.
DAT tapes?
Oh yeah.
And I had a stereo mic.
Very 90s.
Yeah, yeah. It was the thing.
That was our master.
I bought it. Yeah, yeah. And I bought it used, and with a stereo mic
mm-hmm.
from like a friend of ours who was a bassoonist, and she had bought it. She had purchased it for her like classical music recital.
Like Akai, or something, right?
This one was a Sony. But,
Sony, right? Okay.
And that's all I had. Mm-hmm. And I got my first commission, and I knew I had to write it from the road, and so what I did is I took some stainless steel mixing bowls that we had registered for our wedding that were gifts. They were wedding gifts. And
stainless steel what?
Mixing bowls, like for the kitchen.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And I had three of them.
Yeah.
I had three of them, and I had specifically had picked them out months earlier because they had a rim. They have a rim around them, mm-hmm. and the rim has a beautiful tone. When you strike the tone, it is a beautiful tone, and it's one pitch. And then the side is that same pitch, but a different kind of color sound. And then when you turn it over, then you hit the bottom of it, there's a totally different sound that it created. So there was like a lot of complexity to the sound. Because I was always fascinated with sound, but I also kind of knew that maybe I might want to use these as instruments or something. So from the road, living out of our car, essentially, I did this first piece of music where I sampled these three stainless steel mixing bowls that I threw into the car, really extensively. And I built this, and I recorded interviews with people, with older people, about what it felt like to grow old and about their memories and stuff. And then I created a score using fragments of their voices and these stainless steel mixing bowls.
Wow.
And that was my first, you know, professional commission.
That was a commissioned piece but not for a dance.
For a dance, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So there's talking, or you made that, you turned that into rhythmic?
Both. So there was speech, and then what I did is I exploited the natural contours of pitch and rhythm contours of the speech, and I built musical phrases around them.
Mm-hmm.
Built musical phrases around them. You know.
Yeah.
So, and once anything that we say is isolated, of course, and especially repeated, it has its own character, and our brain begins to understand pattern and assign meaning to that pattern, and it's that aspect of our understanding of speech that I was exploiting in order to develop the music.
So this dance, you know, getting commissioned for dance music, you're doing that mm-hmm. until today, right?
It's still something I do a lot. And because my wife is a dancer and choreographer, and now she's a teacher of dance as well, our network of friends and colleagues is largely dancers, you know. Wow. So it's something that's both part of my life professionally, but also relationally and artistically. And
you must love it too, because you've been doing
it. I do. I do love it. It remains a type of art form that I both know something about, but completely don't understand at the same time,
uh-huh.
you know, because I can't do it, you know, and I can't, there's a profound chasm between, between my enjoyment of it and my execution of it, right? Whereas with music, my enjoyment and my execution of it are so entangled
mm-hmm.
that it's one kind of experience of art. And when I was a kid, I still love to draw, but when I was a kid, I was really obsessed with making cartoons, and I had like cartoon characters, and I would do comic strips and stuff like that. I even trademarked a cartoon character, which is funny.
You trademarked?
Yeah. And
wait.
That's like,
what
you
was
know,
the idea behind that?
Oh, just like to go through the, like, just like was like,
this guy's going to make me rich.
No, it was just like to protect my creation.
Right.
Like, oh, send this to the Library of Congress or whatever you do. And, but then eventually that sort of like gave way to a love for music and cross mm-hmm. And crossfaded. But so visual art also feels a little bit close and connected to what I could do.
Right.
Whereas dance is like completely, yeah. I just feel like I can't do it. And it's so, and from that sort of virginal perspective, I appreciate dance in a different way than I appreciate music or visual art.
Mm-hmm.
It remains kind of like separate or other, even though I'm constantly around dancers and seeing dance and writing music for dance, it's just out of reach. And there's something really special about that.
But you're doing it all the time.
Yeah, but I'm not dancing. And I think
right, okay,
experiencing yeah. the magic of dance being made is also like really profoundly amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think unfortunately that's something that most people don't get to experience. They only see the end result. And it's like, it's almost like if you take like an amazing band, right? If you imagine an amazing band in your head and you've only seen them live, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. But imagine if you could go to the rehearsals, what that would feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be amazing. Could be.
Could totally destroy your yeah, your whole. That's true. You know. Wow.
But
I have
this, but in the I, dance studio, idea, you know? But in the dance studio, there's this incredible athleticism and just, force of will mm. that is. The goal at that stage is not to mask the struggle mm-hmm. in the way that often the goal in performance is to mask the struggle. And the struggle of itself is incredibly beautiful and inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the dance that I really connect with most is dance that doesn't abandon that aspect of itself on the stage. That it's wide open. The struggle, the sweat, mm-hmm. the breathing, the agony.
Yeah,
and
the suffering.
It's still there. The suffering is still yeah. there. Yeah.
yeah. All right.
Whatever that says about me, I don't know.
yeah. So when did you... So let's jump to Sunlux. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when did you...
Well, Sunlux really emerged out of that early season yeah. of making music for dance. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the very first Sunlux song I ever began to write started as a piece for dance. Like, and it was 2004.
Okay.
So super long time ago.
Yeah.
And that piece of music became the song Weapons, mm-hmm. which wasn't even, you know, wasn't released until it was on my first record in 2008. And that song, I feel like, is in some ways the initial DNA of the Sunlux project. And the melody of that song is like a fingerprint that I put on a lot of my work. Sometimes I even sneak it into remixes. it actually appears on the final song of our next record that's coming up called Brighter Wounds. And there's this culminating moment with like choirs and all kinds of shit happening and then blasting through the smoke and dirt is this melody that comes out. It's still kind of like
that little bit from 2004.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. But it ultimately, I just felt like somewhere in that season of writing a bunch of music for other people, that there was something that I needed to write for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, you know, years before sort of left my classical composer guy back in the classroom, yeah. you know, at school. And I kind of wanted to unearth him, but I wanted to dig him up and put him to work in a pop context. And I just had these ideas where I felt like my traditional classical music mind could find communion with this guy that was really falling in love with all kinds of pop music that he was experiencing as well. And really Sunlux began as an investigation of the potential of that marriage.
Hmm.
Because I had learned so many amazing things in music school not necessarily, I wasn't necessarily obsessed and enthused by the result of some of the thinking and some of the philosophy that I learned about, but I felt like there was untapped potential in a lot of the ideas, mm-hmm. especially in the context of some pop music conventions. So at the same time, I had certain pet peeves about pop music that I wanted to abandon.
Well, your approach seemingly still academical.
Yeah, very academic, yeah. But balanced again by this. I loved boom bap, and I loved. I was experiencing this music that was like just transforming my brain. Radiohead and Sierros and like these different music from different parts of the world, and I just. I just began to create. Mm-hmm. And at some point, probably 6 or 7 ideas into this thing, I realized I was probably making a record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then once I accepted that reality, then I realized I was probably forming an identity.
Right. Yeah. And did you experience that as a, that must have been a good thing, right? I mean, like,
yeah, actually,
I'm doing something here that I can,
it really was,
I can and show.
No, it was more internal. It was more like I actually never thought that I would sing because I didn't sing. So any ideas that I was recording that I was singing were ideas that I was hoping other people would eventually sing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wait, so
you were making instrumentals?
Yeah, it was mostly instrumental music, but then I had these vocal ideas and I would mm-hmm. record the vocal ideas and then I would show friends and things like that. And one of the common responses I got was, who's this singing? This is really interesting. This is a really cool voice, you know?
Right.
And I would be like, oh yeah, yeah. But that's just temporary. And like,
oh, you had to grow to accept your voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I was learning and I learned it in the context of the studio. And then later on, as when I started to tour much, much later, I started to tour my third record, Lanterns. That's when I started to learn my voice on stage. And, and it's been a process of sort of discovering what my instrument is.
That's the other interesting bit. So you did 2 records and never even played a show mm-hmm. on them.
That's
and
right.
You're just like, I'm just going to produce yeah. music.
I mean, I maybe played like a show a year or something that was just like some weird event.
Alone?
Sometimes alone or like, I actually did a tiny run with the band Y in France. Oh, yeah. 2008, I think after my first record, because we were on the same record label, Anticon. And I went out with a drummer and we played an opening set for them for like 9 shows in France or something like that. But other than that, I'd never toured. And I'm not really sure how I did that.
But how was that part something that you enjoyed?
I hated it.
You hated it?
Yeah. I always hated performing, as Sunlux. And I mean, I also very rarely did it. I mean, I mean, anything that you never really do, you're going to kind of suck at it, especially when you do it in front of a bunch of people and you feel self-conscious.
So on Lanterns, when you started doing it all the time, or like
that's the thing. More. And that's the thing that really changed everything is I as it relates to my live music, which is I met Ian and Rafiq. Mm-hmm. And
how'd you meet?
I met guys? Rafiq actually over email. We had some mutual friends, and he sent me some of his music that he was working on. Mm-hmm. It was totally amazing, and we started talking and we hung out on Skype and really hit it off. And then I invited him to be part of a film score that I was working on, which he did. And then before I was done making it, I invited him to be part of one song, which was Easy. The song Easy. So he plays the guitar on Easy, and wrote the solo section and all that stuff. And working with him was really a great experience. And then when I basically was at a point in my career, because I was also writing commercial music. So I was writing music for ads and, mm-hmm. and work for hire composer guy. Beyond dance. I got to a point just in my career financially where I could take the risk and tour,
mm-hmm.
Cause touring is extremely expensive and, super, super inconvenient in basically every way possible, unless you have the And it's unless it's really what you do and you have the infrastructure to support you.
And it stops you from producing to a degree,
creating.
And so
until much later when you have the infrastructure to actually support that at the same time.
But Lantern sort of set it all on fire, right? I mean,
yeah, and I think part of it is because, I mean, there's a bunch of reasons. I had laid a foundation, like a long foundation, mm-hmm. and I had kept the like bathwater warm mm-hmm. with other projects and with making, you know, with the other releases and some good exposure in some places. And then we just hit the road so hard on Lanterns. We toured that record so hard. Our first tour,
out
for example.
Out of a necessity or because you actually then all of a sudden loved playing with these guys?
No, I didn't know I loved playing with them until we were on stage. And in fact, I would say like our first show ever was in Berlin.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. We had 4 or 5 rehearsals.
Ever
total. We went out on stage in front of 750 at BNU.
Yeah.
And
600.
Is it 600 cap? Yeah, yeah. Well, it's 750 in my mind because next year it'll be 1,000 and two years from now, it'll be, this is 2,000 people at our first show. No, but we were just squeezed in between other bands, you know?
Right.
We remember it was like a sold out show. And it was like, whoa, our first show is like, mm-hmm. there is a sold out crowd. You know, they're not here for us, but you know.
It's they were not?
Well, we were like second to last or something. And it was like three bands. It was like, I don't know. Okay. I don't know. It was a very weird night. It was a strange night. Mm-hmm. It was a traumatic experience. I had this backstage. I was walking up these long steps, these long cement mm-hmm. steps from backstage. I got right near the top and I slipped and I was mm-hmm. holding a glass bottle. I fell on the glass bottle, which shattered and cut my hand.
Oh no.
And my laptop, my bag, which held my laptop, my stage laptop, fell off my shoulder and tumbled all the way down the steps. And this was literally before soundcheck and before the first show. And I was just like, I hate touring.
This shit is doomed.
This shit is doomed. But then we played.
Did it go down
decently well? The only song we didn't get all the way through was Easy, ironically.
Jesus.
And it's because someone had, like, I didn't know at the time to, like, tape my cables and, like, my power cable came undone and then I was on battery and there was, like, a little hiccup or whatever. But because my band was good and we was fine. Yeah. Like, probably, you know, a good 20% of the people maybe noticed that something was weird and everybody else was fine. Mm. But then we did the next show in Cologne, like, and that show was amazing, and I had tons of fun.
And your hand was fine.
And my hand was fine. Yeah, I was wearing Band-Aids for a while, but I just at that point I was like, oh wow, we're a band, and this is pretty cool.
Oh, okay.
And then you know the other thing is Cologne was our first show where it was our show. Mm-hmm. Right. So Berlin was our first show of all time, but it wasn't our show. Mm-hmm. Then we show up to Cologne and there's like a ton of people and they're like, and I'm like, whoa, like
that helps.
Where do these people come from?
Yeah.
Like, how do they even know about Sunlux?
Right.
But just before that,
were on your third album by then.
Yes. Right. Yes. And it didn't hurt that Lord had tweeted, she had tweeted kind of like late fall about the album and in particular the song Easy. And then,
did that really change a course?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I mean, she went on to become like one of the biggest artists in the world.
Yeah.
And had like the world's biggest song and all that stuff. And,
right.
What
was that song called again?
Royals.
Yeah. Yes.
And then we did a version of Easy together. But then she
How
went on.
How did that happen? You just retweeted and then you.
No, she followed me on Twitter. So we just mm-hmm. developed a conversation, direct message. And it turns out she had been listening to Sunlux since she was 11 years old.
Wow.
Because
she was like 16 at the time. Right?
She was 17. And, but she was a fan of the very first record, right? Because uh-huh. she liked Anticon. And so she was like listening to Y and listening, to Sunlux because of those early, like a Bay Area hip hop thing that was happening out of mm-hmm. Anticon. And she was obviously a very like, like interesting kid to be listening to that stuff like so early.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and there were some strange things on that label.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like she heard about Lanterns because of some fire or something, you know.
But I'm still not so sure whether that really informed the audience in Cologne and yours.
No, probably not Cologne. No, especially actually in the car on the way to Cologne, mm-hmm. I made the beat for the new version of Easy that we did together.
Oh, okay.
So that was just really at the start of that whole thing.
And you have these things happening. Wasn't there some emo band that also like?
That was a year later.
What was that?
Yeah, that band Fall Out Boy. They sampled Lost to Trying, and then Halsey sampled Easy.
Okay.
So we
know that's just being sampled again, right?
Yeah. There's a couple.
Those Odd Future guys. Out of that camp. What are they called? Name escapes me. It just came out a couple of days ago.
Easy keeps
going.
We'll see if they actually. Want to properly license that or not?
It's on SoundCloud.
Yeah.
All right. So okay. Well, I know we have to come to an end here.
Yeah.
Should we jump to the new record real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
so. What happened was I fell in love with these guys on tour.
Mm-hmm.
They're
amazing musicians.
Musicians, the thing that happened was I realized something about myself as a musician. In the context of this new chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and it was something pretty fundamental. This feeling that I got on stage, and this thing that I learned about myself that was pretty fundamental. And at the time to have been playing music for close to 30 years, and to only then learn something pretty fundamental about myself.
Yeah,
that's very telling. Mm. You know, so at that point, that really started. That propelled the idea that Sunlux could become a trio, which was something I never thought of before until I met those guys. And then as we toured Lanterns, we started working on the Bones record together. And then as we toured Bones, we started making Brighter Wounds together.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like
So how do you work together? I mean,
so we're all in different places.
Yeah.
But actually it's kind of great because we're on tour. We're all like together, eating mm-hmm. together, sleeping together, waking together, sound checking together.
I know Ian's in Brooklyn. Where's Rafiq?
Rafiq is in Brooklyn as well.
Oh.
And Ian is actually in the process of moving to Dallas. So we're about to be all spread
That's
out.
Right.
But again, it doesn't really matter because like when we're on stage,
mm-hmm.
and we're on tour, we're always together. And then we do travel to be with each other for rehearsals and for like intensive periods of time working together. So Brighter Wounds kind of came together, both separately and together. And I think that works really well because all three of us are working on solo projects. And then as a band, there's a certain amount of separation and I think it's really healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because touring is so intense, that it's really nice to actually, it's like breathing in and breathing out, And I think developing a pace as a band like that is really working.
It's pretty healthy, probably.
Yeah, I think it feels like it. Yeah. And, internet, man, like, we're constantly communicating and constantly sharing ideas and stuff like that. So,
but I'm just thinking about the process of laying down the tracks, laying the actual music.
Yeah. So we do get together in spurts for recording.
Mm-hmm.
And then some recording I can, I do solo from home and mm-hmm. from my home studio, and same with Rafiq. And now Ian's going to have a spot in Dallas where he can record himself as well. So, a lot of times even Rafiq and I lived down the street from each other for a while, and a lot of times we were still just, sending files back and forth,
right.
Yeah. Okay. Like we would get together for coffee, but for music, sometimes we'd still just be apart.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, did you get my file?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So this new album this is informed by all kinds of things that happened over the, over the past.
What? I mean, this was a really intense personal time for me, which I think is the thing that maybe sets Brighter Wounds apart from the rest of the Sunlux catalog, which is that it's definitely my most autobiographical record. you know, every record that you make feels the most personal because it's the newest.
Yeah,
of course. But there's a lot of life experience happened to me right away altogether. Some beautiful stuff and some really hard stuff.
Oh, wait, but you did this. The interesting thing was that there was an EP that came out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Earlier. So when we got together in LA to work on the new record, and it was actually election week, and we were together for a day, and then the next day, you know, hell broke loose, and we spent the rest of the week really just kind of not really focusing on our to-do list, but just kind of creating together and kind of working together as a almost like a therapeutic act.
Mm-hmm.
And the songs that eventually emerged from that week together following the election, kind of that working through trauma together, basically, became the Remedy EP, which we finished up and we released it without a lot of fanfare. But although we did invite 300 fans to sing with us on one song, which is pretty fun. Again, the internet. That Remedy EP was kind of like our just initial gut reaction to the political change and cultural change in the United States. And then we continued working on some of the material that was just really in its infancy before the Remedy EP. And it kind of all blends together, but the Remedy EP essentially had set, there were songs that it kind of like felt like they wanted to be something other than the album. And mm-hmm. they started to feel like they belonged together.
And they were pissed off songs.
They were pissed off songs, yeah.
Majorly
and that,
pissed
yeah, and
off.
That was the first, and there'll be more of that for sure.
Yeah.
But that was the first time that I had written some angry music as Sunlux.
Right. It still sounds Sunlux-ish, but it's I mean, it's topical to a degree.
Yeah.
And
it's really unique in that sense. Mm. It speaks more directly to the moment, yeah. And it also is, there's some really angry shit in there.
Protest yeah. songs. No one's yeah. doing protest songs anymore.
Yeah, we're going to do one of those songs live on tour.
Oh, yeah, which one?
Stolen.
Right. I mean, this is the time for protest songs. Yeah. You would think. I'm, you know, traveling through the country thinking, Jesus Christ, I've never seen this before. Okay, we gotta go.
Yeah, I gotta go, unfortunately. One of the beautiful things that happened to me recently is I had a son. And
well, congratulations.
Yeah, and he's amazing. His name's Remy. But the
How
reason
is
why
he now?
He'll be actually tomorrow, he'll be one.
Okay. Oh wow.
12,
okay.
12. Yeah. So he snuck in
there are songs on your new album called Delivery.
Yeah, yeah. So there are definitely direct references. Yeah. And the song that opens the record is kind of an open letter to him.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I got to cut this short is I got to go pick him up from daycare.
Okay. Well, Remy comes first. All right. Well, thanks very much. Thanks a lot for talking.
Awesome.
And we'll see you on tour.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay, what a nice guy. You're still here. This was a good chat. I thought, he's a deep guy, isn't he? His music is just as deep. He is a proper child prodigy. Very rarely you meet people as talented and as thoughtful and as deep as this guy. So check out his music. Sunlux is his band. Rafiq and Ian are congenial partners in his doing, and yeah, they're going to be touring. I'm touring out of here. This was the last shameless plug for a while, I hope. So the next Spill the Wine episodes will be more neutral. I'll be talking to people I'm not working with, and yeah, thanks for checking in. I hope you do it again. Have a good one.